What's up, bootlickers? I haven't seen y'all since the camp out. I got something to say, right?
Anarchy! Anarchy! I don't even know what that means, but I love it!
Anarchy is, and always has been, the best way and the only morally sensible way to run the world.
Cool. It's not just cool. It's the intersection of life and politics. Activism and action.
There's only one way to get power. Organize. All the workers together. One big union. And the war the IWW wants you to get into is class war. War against the capitalists.
Come on. It's not criminal to be an individual.
It's not criminal to be an individual.
How could you go to a riot without me? You were supposed to be on a riot, buddy.
I'm escaping. One place that hasn't been corrupted by capitalism. Space!
I was a victim too. At least my wife was. She had friends who were socialists.
Oh my god.
Welcome to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, live here in the studio at Grand Street Community Arts. Hope I'm coming in loud and clear. So, I'm always learning. Here in America, there's a bit of our history missing. As Black Panthers would say, if you don't know your own history, you don't know yourself. And it's always part of their program to self-educate, rather educate about your own identity. And as a leftist, I'm always trying to learn about what it means to be a leftist, the history of leftism. It's been buried in our culture, the history of leftism in America, how it has helped build America and make it what it is, as much as any captain of industry or entrepreneur or whatever is promoted by the system today. Why don't we know about leftist history, the leftist movements, how strong they were, how normal they were, that even some of my grandparents were members of a communist party? Well, there was a large propaganda campaign. Usually it's mentioned in passing, or at least as a thing that happened was the House of Un-American Committee. Affairs Committee, you know, led by the Senator McCarthy. It's called the McCarthy era, a few years in the 50s where there was a crackdown on the Reds. Second Red Scare, the first one was in the 20s. And it's kind of talked about as if it was a passing fad, as if it ended at some point. It never ended, people. What it did was it won. It did crush leftism in America. Leftist movements, leftist parties, laws were passed to make it harder for third parties to operate, to collect dues, to have leadership. And sometimes, yes, even assassination was used. Namely, Martin Luther King was the most extreme example of that, or at least blatant. Not blatant, it was very well concealed, but a court case in the 90s discovered through process and evidence that it was the FBI that killed Martin Luther King. Not a conspiracy theory, but fact. And through assassination, as well as just cold, hard censorship, blacklisting, cancel culture, the original cancel culture, the use of bureaucracy to quash opposition. I don't like it in the left. A lot of people don't like it in the left, quote-unquote the left. It's not the left I want, this cancel culture, where one fights for equality and freedom, but less so in the fairness department. Though the argument is made that it is fair to expunge people who are toxic. And there are many cases like that, which is where it gets sticky. But otherwise, where am I? So I'm going to play a clip from a Black leader, early civil rights movement, Paul Robeson. Now, he's a man I don't actually know too much about. And that's kind of where I'm trying to fill the gaps of my knowledge. So that's why this clip is so illustrative, informative of the time, and may give you a sense of this leader, this figure in the civil rights movement that you may have never heard of. Why haven't you heard of him? Why isn't he stand with Malcolm X and Martin Luther King? Because he was a cold red communist, as you'll hear. And why? Because there were Black communist electeds. When there was segregation and Jim Crow, communist Blacks were being elected. That was where the movement was. Because, as my grandmother put it, if you were for equality, you were a communist. Now, as the New Deal coalition marched forward, and this campaign against, by the way, any complaints about censorship by the government these days is very quaint and makes my eyes roll a little, because compared to the 50s and the late 40s and that the Red Scare, just the level of censorship that did exist, that literally you cannot work in this town, literally, if you actually had radical politics and unions, you know, and this is kind of a danger of legalization of things, legalization of sex work, of pot, is that it doesn't get rid of the black market. It doesn't get rid of the demand. It just creates a legitimate version of a thing that is safe for the system, whether it be unions. So then it creates business unions. The New Deal created business unions. But then if there are other unions that wanted to go further, like, say, common ownership, create co-ops out of businesses, that was too radical and still illegal. And so you had legitimate unions, and then you had the illegitimate unions. Public sector unions that would go on strike, for example. Laws were passed. Laws were passed against third parties. Laws were passed against radical organizing, radical parties. And it's basically taken multiple, a lifetime of two, to even get where we are now, which is, of course, not where we really want to be. Our communities are still shattered and on the defensive. So Paul Robeson, he's going to sound like James Earl Jones. And he was kind of the James Earl Jones of the Silent Generation in the 40s and 50s. He was a singer. But before that, he was a football player, which is also mentioned. So he was everything. He was the star athlete. He was the star singer. Anything a famous black person could do at the time, he was. But then he turns his attention as a singer to oration, giving speeches for the cause, traveling internationally, and writing many, maybe poetry itself too, but also many opinion pieces on the state of blacks in America, Jim Crow, and the like, as the civil rights movement was still just kernelizing together, as there were these desperate actions, but it was yet a cohesive whole, though of course it never really was, even in the, as it achieved the victory of the Civil Rights Act, it was still kind of a grouping, a coalition of groups that had many strategic disagreements on how far to take things. You know, the violent versus the nonviolent, the aggressive versus the passive, or I don't know, it was all very radical and socialist. And that is something that is not talked about enough. The left, progressives, do give credence to, at least for Martin Luther King, but I'm going to take another step further and show you the voice of a black communist.
Are you now a member of the Communist Party?
Oh, please, please, please.
Please answer, will you, Mr. Robeson?
What is the Communist Party? What do you mean by that?
Are you now a member of the Communist Party?
Would you like
Party?
To come to the ballot box when I vote and take out the ballot and see?
Mr. Chairman, I respectfully suggest the witness be directed to answer the question.
You are directed to answer the question.
I invoke the Fifth Amendment and forget it.
I respectfully suggest the witness be directed to answer the question whether, if he gave us a truthful answer, he would be supplying information which might be used against him in a criminal proceeding.
You are directed to answer, Mr.
Gentlemen,
Robeson.
In the first place, wherever I have been in the world, the first to die in the struggle against fascism were the communists. I laid many wreaths upon the graves of communists. That is not criminal. Chief Justice Warren has been very clear that the Fifth Amendment does not have anything to do with the inference of criminality, and I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Have you ever been known under the name of John Thomas?
Oh, please, does somebody here want me to put up a perjury someplace? John Thomas, my name is Paul Robeson, and anything I have to say, I have said in public all over the world, and that is why I'm here today.
Mr. Chairman, I ask that you direct the witness to answer the question he's making his speech. I ask you to affirm or deny the fact that your Communist Party name was
I
John Thomas.
I invoke the Fifth Amendment. This is really ridiculous.
The witness talks very loud when he makes a speech, but when he invokes the Fifth Amendment, I can't hear him.
I have medals for diction. Right. I can talk plenty loud.
Will you talk a little louder?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment loudly.
Sir, who are Mr. and Mrs. Vladimir
Nikiev? I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know a Manning Johnson?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know Gregory Kifetz?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know a Max Juergen?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Max Juergen.
Why don't you have these people here to be cross-examined? Could I ask whether this is legal?
This is not only legal, but usual. By unanimous vote, this committee has been instructed to perform this very distasteful task.
To whom am I talking?
You're speaking to the chairman of the committee.
Mr. Walter?
Yes.
The Pennsylvania Walter?
That is right.
Representative of the steel workers?
That is right.
And the coal mining workers?
That is right.
Not United States Steel, by any chance. Our great patriot?
That is right.
You are the author of the bills that are going to keep all kinds of decent people out of the country.
No, only your kind.
Colored people like myself. And you would let in the Teutonic Anglo-Saxon stock.
We are trying to make it easier to get rid of your kind, too.
You don't want any colored people to come in. Could I be allowed to read from my statement?
Will you just tell this committee, please, while under oath, Mr. Robeson, the communists who participated in the preparation of that statement?
Oh, please. The reason I'm here today, from the mouth of the State Department itself, is I should not be allowed to travel because I have struggled for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa. The other reason I'm here today, again, from the State Department and from the record of the Court of Appeals, is that when I am abroad, I speak out against injustices against the Negro people in this land. That is why I'm here. I'm not being tried for whether I'm a communist. I'm being tried for fighting for the rights of my people, who are still second-class citizens in this country, in this United States of America. My mother was born in your state. And my mother was a Quaker. My ancestors, in the time of Washington, baked bread for George Washington's troops when they crossed the Delaware. My father was a slave. I stand here struggling for the rights of my people to be full citizens in this country. And they are not. They are not in Mississippi. They are not in Montgomery, Alabama. They are not in Washington. They are nowhere. And that is why I am here today. You want to shut up every Negro who has the courage to stand up and fight for the rights of his people, for the rights of workers, and I have been on many a picket line for the steel workers, too. And that is why I'm here today.
Would you tell us whether or not you know Thomas W. Young?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Thomas W. Young is a Negro president of the Guide Publishing Company. I'd like to read you his testimony, quote, Paul Robeson has no moral right to place in jeopardy the welfare of the American Negro to advance a foreign cause. In the eyes of the Negro people, this false prophet is unfaithful to their country, and they repudiate him, close quote. Do you know the man that said that?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment now. Can I read my statement? It is a sad and bitter comment.
While you were in Paris in 1949, Mr. Robeson, did you tell an audience the American Negro would never go to war against the Soviet government?
May I say that is slightly out of context. May I explain to you what I did say? I remember the speech very well. 2,000 students who came from populations that would range to 600 or 700 million people asked me to say in their name that they did not want war. No part of my speech in Paris says 15 million American Negroes would do anything. I said it was my feeling that the American people would struggle for peace, and that has been since underscored by the President of these United States. Now, in passing, I said...
Any people who want war?
Listen to me. I said it was unthinkable to me that any people could take up arms in the name of a man like Senator Eastland of Mississippi against anybody. Gentlemen, I still say that. This United States government should go to Mississippi and protect my people. That is what it should do.
I lay before you, sir, an article, quote, I am looking for full freedom, unquote, by Paul Robeson in The Worker, July 3rd, 1949, quote, I said it was unthinkable that the Negro people of America or elsewhere could be drawn into war with the Soviet Union. I repeat it with 100-fold emphasis, they will not, close quote.
And, gentlemen, they have not. It is clear that no Americans are going to go to war with the Soviet Union.
While you were in Stockholm, did you make a little speech?
I made all kinds of speeches.
Let me read you a quotation.
Let me listen.
Do so, please.
I am a lawyer.
It would be a revelation if you would listen to counsel.
In good company, I usually listen. But you know, people wander around in such fancy places.
You said, Mr. Robeson, and I quote, I belong to the American resistance movement, which fights against American imperialism, just as the resistance movement fought against Hitler.
Just like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman were underground railroaders and fighting for our freedom, you bet your life.
I have to insist that you listen to these questions.
I am listening.
I quote further, why should the Negroes ever fight against the only nation in the world where racial discrimination is prohibited and where the people can live freely? Never. They will never fight against either the Soviet Union or the people's democracies, close quote. Did you make that statement?
I do not remember, but what is perfectly clear today is that 900 million people, other colored people, have told you they will not. 400 million in India and millions everywhere have told you
the
that.
The witness has answered the question. He doesn't need to make a speech.
Did you write an article that was published in the USSR Information Bulletin?
Yes.
Quote, I want to emphasize that only here in the Soviet Union did I feel that I was a real man with a capital M, close quote.
I would say, what is your name?
Aaron.
I am quite willing to answer the question. When I was a singer years ago, and this you will have to listen to.
I am listening.
I am a bass singer, so for me, it was Chelyabin, the great Russian bass, not Caruso the tenor. I learned the Russian language to sing their songs. I wish you would listen now.
Mr. Chairman, I ask you to direct the witness to answer the question.
Just be fair with me.
I ask for order.
The great poet of Russia is of African blood.
Well, let's not go so far afield.
It is important to explain this.
Did you make that statement?
When I first went to Russia in 1934...
Did you make that statement?
When I first went to Russia in 1934...
Did you make that statement?
In Russia, I felt for the first time like a full human being. No color prejudice like in Mississippi. No color prejudice like in Washington. It was the first time I felt like a human being. Well, I do not feel the pressure of color as I feel it in this committee today.
Why do you not stay in Russia?
Because my father was a slave, and my people died to build this country. And I'm going to stay here and have a part of it just like you, and no fascist-minded people will drive me from it. Is that clear?
You are here because you are promoting the communist cause.
I am here because I am opposing the neo-fascist cause, which I see arising in these committees. Jefferson could be sitting here, and Frederick Douglass could be sitting here. Eugene Debs could be sitting here.
Now, what prejudice are you talking about? You were graduated from Rutgers. You were graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. I remember seeing you play football at Lehigh. There was no prejudice against you.
Just a moment. This is something I challenge very deeply, that the success of a few Negroes can make up for $700 a year for thousands of Negro families in the South. My father was a slave, and I have cousins who are sharecroppers. I do not see success in terms of myself. I have sacrificed hundreds of thousands of dollars for what I believe in.
While you were in Moscow, Mr. Robeson, did you make a speech lauding Stalin?
I can't remember.
Have you recently changed
your
mind about Stalin?
What Stalin, gentlemen, is a question for the Soviet Union, and I won't argue with a representative of the people who, in building America, wasted the lives of my people. You are responsible, you and your forebears, for 60 to 100 million black people dying in the slave ships and on the plantations. Mm-hmm. Don't you ask me about anybody.
I'm sure you wouldn't want to discuss with us the slave labor camps in the
Soviet
Union.
Nothing could be built more on slavery than this society, I assure you.
I would invite your attention to the Daily Worker of June 29, 1949, with reference to a get-together with you and Ben Davis, formerly Communist Councilman in New York. Do you know Ben
Davis? One of my dearest friends, he is as patriotic an American as can be. And you, gentlemen, are the non-patriots.
Just a minute.
You are the un-American.
The hearing is now adjourned.
I think it should be.
I've endured all of this that I can.
Can I read my statement?
No! The meeting is adjourned!
It should be.
And there you have it. Wonderful clip. You were just listening to Paul Robeson in front of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. But as you may be heard, Paul Robeson is one of the greatest Americans. And I want to know more about him, just like other leftist leaders of our past that have been buried, not celebrated. Maybe in certain communities, maybe in Black Panther Party communities, Black Nationalist communities, Paul Robeson is a known quantity, but not in my community, but it should be. Okay, welcome back to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, your know-it-all activist. And I'm normalizing communism today, I suppose. But instead, I want to alternate between two modes of thinking. I say this show is for the curious or the committed for going in a different direction. And I'm going to alternate between, so I just did something that was for the curious. Are you curious about the civil rights movement before 1960? And who was speaking for it? What was it made up of? The kind of people? The kind of thinking that said, yes, America is a more slave-based society than any gulag could ever be. Maybe a little whataboutism, but as far as saying, look, Jim Crow is in full effect. People are being lynched in the South. This is something we need to take care of. And the committed. So speaking to those who kind of already know there's injustice, want to do something about it, but want ideas. What should we be fighting for? Here are some suggestions via a communist mayor in Chile. As he explains how to govern locally from the left. This is an interview by Daniel Jod. Even under a right-wing government, local leftist leaders can have a massive impact. Daniel Jod describes the people's pharmacy, cheap eye care and glasses, public housing, and other left approaches to community safety, much more instituted during the time of the communist mayor of Rilakoca, one of the 37 municipalities that make up the greater Santiago, Chile area. Santiago is the capital of Chile. It's made up of, as it says, 37 little districts, and he was the mayor of one of them. As it's kind of, as he explains, it's a very centralized system. Chile was governed by a right-wing dictator. And by right-wing, I mean hyper-capitalist. Imagine libertarian ideas and privatization being carried out to the fullest. That is what Chile is like. It's not really great. And it was, as I say, dictatorship, heavy censorship, and death squads of anyone to the left of Bernie Sanders, I guess. No, Bernie Sanders would have been killed too. There's a meme online. It's not a meme. Well, it's basically it's the Fash online who are making this joke. They're making a joke out of it that he executed people by bringing them up in a helicopter and shoving them out. And so they have like T-shirts with like, you know, throw the left out of helicopters. Cute. So, let me begin, and I'll jump around because I just want to get to the core meat of the ideas. When most outsiders think of Chile, the first thing that comes to mind are the scars left by the civilian military dictatorship. For good reason, the legacy of Pinochet's genocidal regime is everywhere, in personal and collective memories. In the country's privatized institutions like education, and its profoundly neoliberal constitution, which keeps the Chilean political system shackled to this brutal past and makes left politics very, very difficult. Nonetheless, the legacy of the revolution, led by supporters of Salvador Allende's socialist government, the one that was overthrown by the CIA, despite, well, with help of the CIA, obviously, Pinochet and his supporters were a small right-wing group, and they were assisted. Despite opposition from a broad sector of anti-constitutional military leaders and the Chilean oligarchy, popular resistance never died out or gave in, even in the face of the intervention by President Nixon's government, which played a key role in the military coup, September 11th, 1973. So they remember September 11th for a different reason. Which isn't that interesting. That was a day that America helped cause a terror campaign in another country. Jod himself is a militant in the Communist Party of Chile and one of the most important figures in the Latin American left. We all have a lot to learn from what is happening in Rilakoca, especially since one of the most persistent criticisms of actually existing socialisms has been their supposed administrative failures, their inefficiency in actually serving the people. With his successful measures, Jade defies not just the historical stereotype, but the realities under the entire neoliberal system. He explains how basically the city is broken up into little districts and then it's everything. It's all very centralized. But it is kind of up to each district. They're pretty much on their own. This is neoliberalism in its purest form. So those with rich people can have, and every district is responsible for all of its own services. There is no state funding. Only state enforcement of law. Let's see. He mentions that the city that he governed had a population of 162,000. This facilitates a marked class segregation between different municipalities across the metropolitan region. It also, however, gives municipal governments the opportunity to be laboratories for change, like what you are doing. Which is kind of the argument for charter schools and other privatization. It, without government interference, it allows people to freely experiment. But you still need resources to do that. So Jode says, this is the first opportunity we've truly been afforded to turn a municipality into a laboratory for change. Generally, confronting the country's development model requires political conviction. But such conviction wasn't previously widespread. Nowadays, however, the Chilean Communist Party is starting to grow again, recovering from the annihilation, keyword, it underwent over the course of the dictatorship that the U.S. installed, encouraged, and defended. The party spent many years fighting just to survive, as it was the party it hit hardest. But in recent years, CP has been undergoing a resurgence. Accomplishments by local communist governments have given citizens a renewed hope in our party and in themselves. Not just in Reykjavik, but he names other cities or towns. The central state keeps 80% of the government's budgetary resources, while the regional governments receive only 8%. This is not too far from our share, actually. Leaving a mere 12% for the country's 345 municipal governments. This results in a tremendous asymmetry, and it's a product of the development model. Why? Because while some municipal governments can budget $2,000 per inhabitant each year, others only $120. Not surprisingly, the first is a municipality where the dominant classes live, whereas the second is a totally peripheral community, not just in terms of location, but also in regards to its level of its residents. First, I want to talk about popular services in that you're building. What is the open school? We have this concept that the state should be responding to the needs of its citizens. Wonderful. Can't fancy that. What happened first was some young men came to us saying they wanted to get off the streets. They all agree they wanted less crime, alcohol, and drug abuse around them. But when they tried to go to local organizations for help finding a good place to meet, they were turned away. Whether they went to social organizations, neighborhood councils, retirement homes, or the government, they always got the same answer. There was no space available for young people to get together and participate in activities that are age appropriate. You know, roughhousing and whatnot. Or just generally being loud and obnoxious? Shrug. The core problem was a lack of facilities. And by the way, this should sound very, very familiar. It certainly does to me. Enrico Lea didn't have the resources needed to build these type of facilities that you were requesting. However, we were able to get together with our young people and come up with a solution, determining that we should make use of the public schools as they were only occupied until 4. It made no sense for schools to be empty by 4 p.m., with no one taking advantage of their facilities. So we decided to create the open school program, keeping schools open until 10 p.m., and over the weekend as well. This gave the whole community the opportunity to make use of the spaces as they saw fit, the fields, the gyms, and the classrooms. Now, this is a fantastic idea. Our local school district, to my knowledge, doesn't do it, and my experience as well, because I attempted to reserve a space in the school after 4 p.m. for a political event. And so I was just asking for what the constraints and the process was. And I can tell you, it was bad. I think first they wanted insurance, they wanted you to have insurance. So good luck if you're not a nonprofit with a, you know, multi-$1,000 insurance policy. They said you needed up to $100,000 of insurance. Great. So you gotta buy a policy for that. Certain nonprofits have that, so it's like you need to be under a nonprofit umbrella. So no grassroots organizing for you, really, unless you incorporate, which itself is like a year process. Okay, with this arrangement, we were able to provide young people with a safe alternative to the street. Families were also well served, especially the women who had to work and take care of their families. Where previously there may have been nowhere for kids to go to school, now here in Albany, we had a YMCA, but they're all basically closing. They're all being run out of town by charter school execs and owners that they're attached to or something like that. We currently just have a small YMCA in North Albany. Even that's like moving. They may move to a new location in the city. But the main branch that was centrally located closed. And yes, well, you know, more rowdy teens on the streets. From there, we've been able to launch other projects. For example, we have now taken proposals from professors who want to teach free university classes as part of this program. Our plan is to create an open university that offers anyone in the community access to free university classes in every subject area. Volunteer professors will teach at schools throughout the community. Course offerings will be in areas such as history, philosophy, so on and so on. There are no requirements. The program is open and completely free. What sort of activities do the young people who participate in the Open Schools program engage in? Asks the interviewer. They can participate in athletic, rec, cultural activities. They do homework. They get together to chat. They have classes from everything from dance to football. That's soccer for you barbarians. Any sport they want, they can create a class. They run popular pre-university prep courses. Municipality organizes a number of activities, but almost 70% are self-directed by both the older and the younger people who attend. Just give them the space. Let them think about what they would use it for. Don't tell them what to do. Maybe that's why they don't stick around. But I think, yes. I mean, when I'm at the high school, they basically want everyone to leave before 3 o'clock. And you're only allowed to stay if you're basically in a club or have a slip or, you know, a pass for the, you know, after school activities, which are, you know, they exist, but they're also very limited. The project seems to be about making public spaces more deeply public. He says, that's the idea, to make our public spaces the heart of the community, because we understand that the community is the state. We are not the state. They are the state. Everything we have, the resources, the infrastructure, the facilities, they're theirs. And everything we do not for ourselves, meaning the administrators, but for them. That is what it means to be a lefty. To not see the state as some kind of opposition to freedom, but the facilitator of it. Could you explain the People's Pharmacy Project? How did it start? Why, out of all the services you could have chosen, did you choose a pharmacy? It was one of the major issues that our senior citizens asked to address. We have very few doctors and just a few medical offices. 4. In a community for 162,000. That's one medical practice for every 40,000 people. And these clinics were obsolete, more than 30 years old. Prior to looking into the problem, the community had a mere 11 doctors, working out to just 4 medical offices. So the first solution we came up with was to increase the number of doctors from 11 to 40. But we then ran into problems with overcrowding with 29 new doctors at just 4 clinics. The question of transportation is crucial. Senior citizens told us, we're tired of getting up at 5 a.m. to go and get a number and wait in line. Due to the overcrowding, we couldn't meet all our citizens' medical needs with solely the addition of more doctors. With our deep conviction that the citizenry is indeed the state, we went to the neighborhood council and said, let's resolve these problems together. We built 2 medical hubs for non-invasive primary care at each of the neighborhood councils. I guess they have their own building. We were able to provide 75% of senior citizens with medical access within 3 blocks of where they live. But in particular, emphasis on those citizens who most often needed to access these medical services. Now, here in our city and our American cities, medical establishments and facilities are kind of spaced far apart. They're not in the neighborhood. If you're old, you have to be driven to your medical appointments, which creates a whole nother industry of Medicab, Uber rides, the need for more driving, the need for this distance, which should not be. And it just creates barriers to those who don't have access. Now, Medicaid, for the most part, does pay for these things. But why does it need to pay for these things? That just increases the cost of healthcare. If it was closer, then that would be a cost that wouldn't have to exist. They could walk there, they could be escorted if they are hard of walking. But a few blocks is not too far for someone even with a walker or cane. And it mentions, you know, medicine, just like here in America, really, really difficult to get, really. So they started a to mention, though, because of the Constitution, the state, rather the local government, can't engage in commerce. We have that here, too. So usually we set up nonprofits or these pseudo-public arms. They formed a consumer cooperative with the goal of driving down the cost of medication. We ran into a lot of issues with Chilean law, but eventually we were able to zero in on our best option. We determined that the municipality would form its own people's pharmacy, taking on all operational costs. Furthermore, since Chilean law prohibits the state from engaging in kind of commerce, we operate as a nonprofit. And that the Constitution, with its setup, is the root of the dictatorship. If the Constitution was put in place under a dictatorship, it's by definition not a democracy. And Jihad responds, and yet there are still those in Chile who lecture other countries on democracy. What's most important is that our pharmacy has become a beta model that has been replicated all over the place. So, one Dan is talking to another, and I'm a third. So maybe it's a three Dan show. But the interviewer asks him, explain why you wanted to have a people's bookstore, and why you think the right to learn and acquire knowledge is so important. Now, a public bookstore, that's something I don't think exists here in America that I know of. There are anarchist bookstores, radical bookstores, women's bookstores set up and run like in their co-ops. And there's your really nice locally owned bookshop that's very small. You're lucky to have one. They're kind of a dying breed, but obviously they're those that kind of keep it up, usually as a hobby or as part of a larger business, as my friend does. And but public bookstores, why have a public bookstore? Why should that be nationalized? Why should that be a public service, books? Okay, he answers, this has been a very long process of cultural change. We communists define consciousness as the ability to realize your own capacity to transform your own environment so that it will truly satisfy your needs. All right? Not just for the sake of it. For this reason, developing critical thinking skills and deepening societal awareness will always be among the most important of our pursuits. That's where you plant the seed, the raw material for innovation, for social change, for improving the quality of life. Quality of life. For answering, and that's the thing. Quality of life is something preached about by conservatives and homeowners in my city. Quality of life. They care about quality of life. But they never want to address the structures. They never want to have any awareness beyond just there's something around me that I don't like. They have a very small bubble, and they need to grow their consciousness raising, right? Protests are usually called consciousness raising or other kind of awareness campaigns, but it's more than advertising. It's gauging and learning and reading. This power knowledge has to help people realize their transformational potential and cannot be made available only to the rich. Human talent and the ability to affect change are equally distributed across all classes, believing in quality first. And furthermore, it is just recently that we heard about universities in the United States that took bribes to admit less talented students. This allows people with no talent to keep their access to high status. Meanwhile, others who really do have the talent are shut out. This is notable because it is perhaps the most important site creating the majority of society's inequality in education. And this I want to mention a little quip about the use of the word common sense. Now, I'm not, when I was rambling with a coworker, it took me a moment because I usually kind of have this visceral, like, common sense, it's really uncommon. It's really quite a useless phrase. But I'll rephrase that. Common sense is fine. It assumes that we're all equal. And that's good. It's good to believe that we all have the capacity to think clearly, critically, and not bullcrap ourselves and each other. But that is not the case in America today. We are a deeply unequal society. So if you want to talk to me about common sense, you better be talking about fully funding schools equally from the state level down. You better be talking to me about free college, making college as accessible and normal as high school. Tri-tary education. You have primary, secondary, tri-tary education. It's one after the other. All right? And that tri-tary education, yeah, it can be trade school. It could be a foreign learning trip, you know, taking a break. You know, these things are equivalent in cost, more or less, so they could be. Or it could be given in a lump sum to start a business right away or something like that. But it should be a pocket of resources that are there for you to get started as an adult. So in reinforcing inequality through barriers to education, we're talking about how the current system is reproduced. Judge says, and also cultural reproduction. When you have a community that lacks access to culture, you end up reproducing a conservative model. The model reproduces itself by asserting in the common spaces and broadcasting lies, putting forth a false facade of certainty. The interviewer says, where you consume culture produced by others. John says, of course, and in our country, being right-wing is quite easy. Turn on the TV, watch CNN or the national news, read the news, main newspapers. Anything you look at will guide you to the right, where they are feeding you the supposed certainties. To be on the left, you have to study a lot, because you won't find anything in your immediate surroundings to guide you leftward. So people on the left tend to be much more well-read and have a much more complex way of understanding the world, and also more diversity in the way we understand it. And that's a huge opportunity, which is why the open school, the open university, the public library system, the popular bookstore, and some other projects coming soon are so crucial. They are aimed directly at building the community capable of critiquing and transforming their environment. And then they talk about the kind of stereotype that poor people don't like to read. Well, maybe they just don't have books available. Like most problems with being poor is a lack of resources. You can't just walk in the borders and put down $20 or $30 for a book. It's got to be a dollar. It's got to be $5. And that's what his aim was with his public bookstore. I mean, a library can be thought of as a public bookstore, but there is something to actually taking the book home and knowing it's yours. Especially since in Chile, maybe public libraries are non-existent. I mean, you mentioned them, so maybe they do, but maybe they're likely very underfunded. Here in Albany, we have a great library system, so we probably don't need to talk about having a public bookshop, but we also have very few actual bookstores as well, and they certainly don't exist in the poor neighborhoods. And he mentions the reason why, okay, the book industry in Chile, of course, like everything else, is it's privatized completely. The answer is very simple. So the practical question, how are you able to sell books at such a low price? How low are we talking? The answer is very simple, he says. The books industry in Chile is very small. We have 345 municipal governments, but 294 of them don't have a bookstore. That is to say, if you want to buy a book once you are out of school, in 85% of the country, there is nowhere for you to do so. So this industry has to make do earning profits in a very small market, and everything they publish is very expensive. How is profit distribution arranged in this industry? 10% stays in the hands of the writer, 15% goes to the editor, a quarter goes to the publisher, and the final 20% to the distributor. Who delivers the book from the publisher to the final point of sale? 30% goes to the bookstore at the final sale point. Add to that the VAT, the value-added tax, which is the policy darling of right libertarians, the value-added tax which you have to pay here. Our country has never wanted to discuss the elimination of this tax on culture. The interviewer says, and it's a very aggressive tax. Jod says, absolutely. So what do? The same thing we did for the pharmacy. We made a commitment to the culture of our city and invested in the promotion of reading. Our biggest resources are the 10 public libraries, which make us the municipality with the most public libraries in the country. After arranging for an annual investment of $500,000 a year in our system, the next step was the construction of a popular bookstore. The municipality was able to cover all operational costs, paying for the location, the salaries, and all the bills. We can then pass these savings to the public, selling books at the point of price, same price we got them from the publisher, depending on the case. This is why we don't charge a cent more than at which the price books sold to us. Since we don't have to mark up books to cover costs, we can eliminate 30% of the price. We can also knock off an additional 10%, which publishers sometimes tag on when selling books to non-distributors. So we were able to give you up to a 40% discount on new books compared to market prices. And the interviewer asks, it can't be illegal competition because they never even tried to enter the market. It didn't exist. It's that simple. That's why we settled on a bookstore. Because like you said, there are a lot of myths in this country about books. For example, there's this myth that people simply don't like to read. That poor people don't want to read. And also that high prices weren't the problem, but rather a lack of interest in reading. But our bookstore proves this to be false. It's been a great success and is going strong today. The store is constantly adding to its collection. And this is something again and again and again. Programs are blocked or ideas are stopped because conservatives will say that people don't really want this. They're not interested. The poor, the working class. But really, they just need the resources. They need the time. Time is a resource. And it's just, there's this confusion that they can't do these things. But really, it's prohibitively expensive. It takes a bit of an investment to take up certain hobbies, to learn certain skills. Now, a do-it-yourselfer can point out that, let's say, they learned a simple homesteading skill for a few hundred dollars. Okay, but you still need that few hundred dollars. And if you're living paycheck to paycheck, which many, many are, that's still a barrier. I have a few hundred dollars. Me, Dan Platt. But I'm still kind of skittish about spending a large amount at a time. Okay, and the next minutes, kind of behind on things. But this is a longer piece with a lot of content. So let's finish up the hour with the last kind of thing in this piece. Still a lot more, actually. But social housing. What type of social housing needs are you facing in Recoleta and as a country as a whole? What do you hope to construct in both material and symbolic sense of the word? Now, this is an interesting answer he gives in a bit of dialogue because he actually explains the necessity of renting, why people rent, which is befuddles people. Like, why do you want to keep renting? Why don't young people want to buy a house? And I've been trying to hit on this, and he does. He hits it very well because it comes from his experience. The first thing to point out is how the dictatorship, and by the way, he could be talking about the American government. Now, we're not a dictatorship. But when the military says jump, politicians say how high. And by the military forces, I mean, you know, the military industrial complex and so on. And that whole culture, which I can get be a very sore spot for those that are traumatized by war, which I'm very much conscious of. The dictatorship fomented this idea in the mass consciousness that it was necessary to become a homeowner. And so everybody ends up wanting to be a property owner here. But this is impossible for a significant percentage of the people who cannot afford to buy a home. This dream arises out of a basic uncertainty. When you ask an older adult, why do you want to have a house? Why do you dream of having a house? They tell you, because I want to have a place to rest my bones, to stay until I die. They know that the state is completely absent, unwilling to provide you with security or the right to live a dignified life until the day you die. For us, the right to live with dignity is much more important than the right to be a property owner. This is true for a variety of reasons, the first being the natural fluidity, or dynamism, of housing needs. When you live with your parents, you don't need a home. If you leave home when you're single, you only need a studio. If you become part of a couple, you need a bedroom as well. If you have the first child, then you need two bedrooms. If you have another child of the opposite sex, a third bedroom. When the children grow up, you don't need at least one of those bedrooms. So it just sits there unused. And then the second child leaves or gets married, and you have just an extra bedroom you don't need. Then you get separated from your partner and only need your room again. Or you go back home to live with your parents. So I don't think it's worth it to pay into the financial system 25 to 30 years, paying four times the original value just for the privilege of being a homeowner. I really don't think this makes any sense. And so we have to guarantee via state intervention in the retail market that everyone who can buy a home can rent one at a fair price. This is why we're constructing Chile's first public housing, which we've never truly had. Social housing has been built, but always with the intention of giving it to people as property. but never public housing which actually remains in state hands, so that it can be rented out at a fair price. Another great thing about building social housing is it permits the state to intervene in and remodel the city with a different vision. If you leave it to the market, we know perfectly well what happens in Chile. We have seen how the market builds the city, guided only by its own profits and needs, never the good of the city. Now, we have public housing here, and it's well-liked, and some of it is, I think, rent, but, like, sometimes the models, like our housing authority, like, they built a lot of detached single homes, and like, they made a neighborhood of the single detached homes that are still social housing, you know, to get away from the projects. And I think the newest addition to the inventory going up is kind of a good mix of a six-story slab building, and instead of a, you know, tower project in the cross shape, and then a bunch of kind of two, three-story townhouses, which I think are very ugly, though they do have sod roofs. So anyway, I'm going to go to the middle break and go on to the next portion of the show, the second hour.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, just as I am standing by my bed, they framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead, says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe, they shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Three Left Show, live in the studio at Grand Street Community Arts, WCAALP, The Voice, Left Wing Reading Hour for the Curious of the Committed. Yeah, I'm going to do my housekeeping now. We're on Facebook. I'm live streaming right now, Three Left Show. Online, the web, all episodes are archived at threelefts.news. I have a Patreon account if you'd like to help support outreach efforts. I definitely need help doing outreach, and a few extra ducats in my bank account will certainly give me the impetus to do more printing and more flyering in my local community, but also pay for some Facebook ads too. That is also not free. goddamn private public marketplace of ideas. I'm covering, broadly speaking, general international conflict. What is it really? What's the big picture? So I want to talk about a concept. I'm not like a, it's not a full dogma or whatever, but it's just a concept called third worldism. And it's just the idea that global social change, political change, is not going to come from the imperial core, i.e. us here in America, even from the marginalized inside America, where the argument is just, if anyone, and this is going to be covered in the next article I'm going to do, but the real marginalized of the world are out there. They're in the places like Chile, the places where the boot of dictatorship has been a real, consistent presence. The violence of U.S.-backed regimes and the like, and our allies, whatever form they take. It is not we here in America that will be the leaders of the revolution, trademark. It will be out in the marginalized countries, the places, the margins, the bottom of the the global supply chain. It will be in the copper mines in Africa. It will be in the sugar plantations of Indonesia. It will be in the mountains of Rojava, of Kurdistan. Now, the article I have in front of me here is a blog by Hawsin Aziz, Reflections of a Kurdish Feminist. Article is called No Longer the Kurdish Question, but the Kurdish Alternative. Now, a lot of terms and things are going to be referenced, and I'm going to do my best to pop in as I read with short explanations to keep things moving. But also, it's like, well, what is that? What is that? I don't have time to read a book on this and that. Don't worry. That's what this show is for. Kurdish question, like, whenever you have an ethnic group in question, it's usually you have a group who do not have their own nation state. They don't have their own authority. They're not internationally recognized, or they don't have the standing to be recognized and to act like a nation state. But they're still a cultural group, still distinct, but they're not assimilating. Why don't they want to assimilate? You know, it's like how in America, maybe we had the Indian question, the Navajo question, the Seminole question. What do we do with these people? They're just in the way. Or it frightens us that they don't want to be just like us. Why do they want to retain their own culture, their own identity? It's so weird. So you have the Kurds, mountain people, that have always been there as a distinct cultural group. They go back thousands of years. But they've never had their own country. They've never been the leaders of their own empire. They've always been kind of the mercenaries or the cannon fodder for anyone else. And that includes the current, quote-unquote, empires of the region. NATO and Iran and Saudi Arabia, each having their own respective superpowers backing them up. So it's either a fallacy or a pure symbolic violence to continue to assume the Kurdish question as unresolved. Kurdish question is, why don't these people assimilate? Like, what do we do with them? You know, the Jewish question has always been, can Jews assimilate in a society? Can they be active members but as a cultural subgroup? Or do they need their own state? Do they need their own country? That's kind of the binary of the Jewish question. Or do they always need to be apart? And that goes for Kurds. Can they be citizens of Turkey? Can they be citizens of Iran? So the Kurds as an ethnic group, if you don't know, some are in Iran. It goes across Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Syria for the most part. And so there's Kurds in each of these countries. And eventually they might want to form a Kurdistan, but actually that's not really the plan anymore. Is the trend and the strategy that's working is to form autonomous regions within each of these nation states. Autonomous as in local government, not subservient to the central authority, but still citizens. They're still Syrian citizens paying taxes and working with the army, you know, joining the army. For scholars, policy experts, and political bureaucrats, the Kurdish question, with its complex sub- and supranational political implications, remains at the most pertinent dilemma of our modern times, at least if you live in the Middle East, or Western Asia. The epic resistance that occurs against Daesh, but they use Daesh, which means the marauders or the bandits. It's ISIS. They're talking about ISIS. By the YPG and the YPJ, these are like people's protection units. They're like people's army. The difference between the G and the J is that the J is all women. Propelled by the Kurdish question into the international spotlight like never before, seminar and conferences are held, papers and books are written at a rapid pace, and the people across social media flock to hundreds of pro-Kurdish pages thirsty for information. I've read from one of them in an earlier episode, back in like episode 10 or something. And perhaps the clinical label of Kurdish question was employable, for the Kurds and their stubborn refusal to assimilate, be Turks, Arabs, or Persians, resulted in increasing levels of violence by the states, those states, to address this quote-unquote problem. Consequently, for decades the Kurds faced ethnic cleansing, ethnic displacement, Arabization policies, genocide, of course, and the loss of even the most rudimentary human rights, resulting from the arbitrary and artificial states who themselves were produced by violent colonial pens. And that's literal pens. Like, Britain drew the borders and said, these are the nation states here. Artificial states and their repressive and ideological machinations promoted violent, oppressive policies and politics, resulting in the construction of these imagined national identities like Syrian and Iranian, and a mythical one history, one nation, one language, one flag constructs. Turkey is also one of these. This blood-saturated identity was not unique to only post-colonial states, but structurally all modern nation-states. It is the underlying weakness of nation-states, and why, in the 21st century, I'm of the mind that they will be phased out. Old monarchy-based states were phased out with the Enlightenment and industrial era. The nation-state became the default of how people organize themselves. I think we will be moving more towards cultural federations or something of that nature. So something this article doesn't mention, because it just kind of assumes you know, Turkey outlawed the teaching of Kurdish, the language, in any schools. It's illegal, and basically there are these Kurdish cities or towns where the majority of this ethnic population, they have shelled them. Not exaggerating, artillery bombardment of cities that failed to comply with Turkish policies, which is what, and mostly because there's the PKK, Kurdish Communist Party in Turkey, and they are classified by our State Department as a terrorist group. They are in fact fighting a guerrilla war against Turkey, but when your cities are being shelled, I don't think a diplomatic process is available. You kind of have to force your opponent to the table with counterviolence. At least show them that you will stick up for yourself. And that's been a struggle that they've been doing for decades, but their politics have changed a bit from being hardline Marxists to more softer democratic confederalists, is the phrase, which will be mentioned a bit. So it goes into Eurocentric Orientalist, which is like, you know, talking down to the people of the region. To be sure, the ongoing violence towards the Kurds continues to demonstrate the supremacy and the failure of the Eurocentric, state-centric international system. Because the Kurds go beyond being a nation state, because they are beyond being citizens of any particular state. That is why it's a question of what do we do with these people? More importantly, it demonstrates the failure of the neoliberal democracy, you know, representative liberal democracy that has over our lifetimes transformed into what is going to be called here neoliberal democracy, because that's what it is. It's a democracy in name only. It's a democracy where corporations and corporate power rules. Also a paradigm of the New World Order. Privatization, markets, deregulation, outsourcing, disempowering trade unions, reduced taxation for the rich, an even increasing gap between rich and poor, depoliticizing people as well, being anti-intellectual, the global financial crisis, and so on. neocolonial wars resulting in disasters that have been Iraq and Afghanistan, the rise of ISIS and other locally grown but internationally stemming terrorist orgs, and the associated arms industry are all symptoms of failures of this Eurocentric, state-centric, neoliberal democracy. Quite a mouthful. Even as the Kurds and other ethno-religious minorities empowered by the practice of democratic confederalism, their new ideology, continue to produce radical grassroots democracy, communes, and co-ops, street, local, regional councils, with the purpose of increasing the political involvement of those who live there, participation, as well as ownership, even as they attempt to remove decades of protracted primordial conflicts and hatred and replace it with a relationship based on communal values of tolerance and mutual coexistence. As Western academics, experts, and policymakers continue to grapple with the Kurdish question, their focus should instead be on the inherent failure of their blood-stained capitalist infrastructure and its neoliberal democracy, and its inability to effectively respond to and sufficiently balance the different needs of its own exploited masses, as well as minority groups and interests. Instead, neoliberal democracy continues to promote aggressive cultural homogeneity, meaning everyone should be the same. Isn't it curious, I'm asking, that in these democratic, multicultural societies, there are these wars and conflicts propagated to make sure people are toe a certain line. Even in our own cities, go against the government, go against the police, and you are traitors. You must be put down. And whenever a black man is shot down, that is in the mind of the community members who mourn that we are just trying to exist here, and we're not allowed to do that. Because we're not allowed by barriers, by poverty, to participate in the mainstream economy. We have to create our own black market, illicit, dangerous. And for that, criminalization continues. The only way you win is you actually break off. But that's not allowed. Because you have to be taxed, you have to be ticketed for having broken taillights. As cultural groups and subcultures, we don't really fit into this hegemony of the nation state anymore. The nation state has these cracks, the symptoms of this underlying illness, symptoms like Trump, symptoms like basically all our problems. This writer, a Kurdish feminist, Hazin Aziz, goes into kind of the mythical ideas of our American culture that dominated the 90s and the aughts. She describes how in Australia they've, to maintain national cohesiveness, you know, to protect the nation state, expressed through enlightenment racial schema, which is, you know, a way of thinking, and its offshoot of xenophobic identity politics that culminates in the disastrous Tampa affair in Australia, which turned away the boat people or the collective subhumans at the bottom of the racial schema. The then PM John Howard's decree that, quote, we decide who comes into this country and the circumstances in which they come, a policy approach which has underpinned later labor governments, resulting in the establishment of on and offshore detention centers. Imprisonment, mental illness, murder, rape, and already vulnerable children and women seeking refuge and attempted suicides are some of the resulting byproducts of these forced detentions for months, if not years on end. Thousands more die across seas attempting to reach, quote, safe harbors. They are already working hard to build walls of steel to keep them out. Alan Kurdi's lifeless body spoke to this grisly truth. Obviously, this is happening in America as well. All Western civilized countries are building walls and armies and militarized police forces to protect this thing called the nation state. The thing that apparently protects us from what exactly? In contrast, the Kurdish people and other minorities in the Middle East, empowered and liberated through the practice of democratic confederalism, which is a type of grassroots socialism, are supporting hundreds of thousands of refugees and internally displaced people, acronym IDP. The city of Kobani itself shattered beyond recognition because it was bombed to hell as ISIS tried to take it, but failed. Hosts an IDP camp numbering over 5,000 people. Likewise, Sirius and Afrin cantons, provinces, embrace thousands of displaced and terrified people escaping the Assad regime brutality, or Daesh, or both. True democratic ideologies empower and promote collective human capacity and increase rather than rely and function on a decreasing humanitarianism, which exists here in our liberal class in America. In places like American Britain, neoliberal democracy is well on its way towards decay, and in all three of the above countries, oligarchs continue to dominate markets, political decisions, and process with inequality. I mentioned Thatcher, and then Trump, Black Lives Matter as a response to that, shutting down Planned Parenthood. If you follow the news even tangentially, you're aware of what it means for liberal democracy to be in decay. It is all around us. It is everywhere. But Europe is also not free from this withering away of the so-called capitalist democracy. The most recent Freedom House report warned that the migration crisis and wrenching economic problems are threatening the survival of the European Union. Increased lack of transparency and accountability has resulted in a decline of these nascent democracies in the Balkans, resulting in a disturbing deterioration. They've all gone right wing. Serbia, Montenegro, Macedonia have used political strongmen to wrestle leniency from the EU and increasingly defunct union of 28 capitalist democracies, whose collective woeful response to the so-called refugee crisis has demonstrated its inherent moral bankruptcy. Back to the Kurdish question with Turkey's war crimes. But goes into, then I'm going to pivot to the next paragraph. The mythical Fukuyamian end of history, so confidently professed by academics and intellectuals of the New World Order, led by American hegemony, have proven utterly debunked as an alternative, locally produced, radical democratic model, that is, democratic confederalism, demonstrates the failures of capitalist democracy that has reemerged in the Middle East. Likewise, Huntington, different historian, his prophecy of a clash of civilizations was prophesied between the West and Islam, particularly in the post-9/11 world. However, it could not conceive that the clash would occur between, not those two things, the West, whatever the hell that is, and Islam, many billions of people, but between neoliberal democracy, whose internal decay demonstrates inherent inconsistencies and the antagonisms, like that give rise to Black Lives Matter, Occupy, and basically any social movement, and radical democracy defined as democratic confederalism and developed by Abdulhan Öcalan and informed by the works of Murray Bookchin, Vermont anarchist. Fancy enough, I didn't actually know this, but Green Party politics here in America are also informed by Murray Bookchin, at least mine certainly are, and so are Howie Hawkins. Eurocentric, state-centric, neoliberal democracy never imagined that its so-called clash of civilizations would be with an alternative democratic system. It assumed that its democratic system would prove the only viable alternative against fascists, terrorists, and other violence. Its blindness could not account for, not even consider, a non-Western rationalism. Instead, its inherent Eurocentric Orientalist blindsided the neoliberal hawks who imagined only a world filled with Islamic terrorists to fuel their never-ending war machines. The neoliberals continued to dominate and reorient major international bodies and institutions, including the UN, NATO, World Bank, into promoting its version of capitalist democracy. But as Mohammed Takafkofi Targi notes, alternative non-European, non-West-centric, and social developments and processes have been characterized as an absence of change and as an unhistorical history. Basically saying it's like never existed. This whole clash of civilizations between the West and Islam, it was something cooked up by the Warhawks. You know, to find enemies out there. To make them, even. Which, of course, is the case. When the real enemy, the unnamed enemy of our country, is democracy. Are you getting it? The clash of civilization is a democratic society starting to be born, and in the flames of our colonial wars, like in Iraq and Syria, and in our corrupt swamp of a civilization, the civilization that gives us people like Trump and then allows them by means of all the reasons that how it happened, Trump to be our so-called leader. It's time as Kurdish activists and academics to cease wondering over the, and so that's who the audience of this article is. Sorry, not sorry. To cease wondering over the apparently ever unresolvable and ongoing Kurdish question. We are not a question to be solved. We are not a mathematical formula. We are a rational collective of deeply oppressed people whose liberation ideology has produced a model for our own and millions of other colonized, a solution to capitalist modernity, which at a loss to solve other than through genocides and ethnic cleansing. That is how capitalism solves its problems. As if we fail to effectively realize the significance of this, then we reduce the significance of the new paradigm, which is proving most effective in challenging the 5,000 years of state-based exploitation and patriarchy. It is no longer the Kurdish question, but the Kurdish alternative that needs to be the focus of our attention. The Kurds have proceeded to locate the solution to the problem that they never were the problem. The true question is how hard this Eurocentric, state-centric, neoliberal system will fight accepting its spectacular defeat. I'm not sure how to follow that. I will try. So to turn towards, to continue the second hour's theme of kind of third worldism, that the challenges to our system are not going to come from within. You know, how we're siloed into reformism and so on, and projects that don't really liberate us, because we can't really liberate ourselves. We're part of the core. Whatever we're fighting for, let's say it's social democracy, meaning more welfare, free college, and so on, it's still based on, it still depends on our empire. It still depends on us trading and having a massive trade indifference with other countries, you know? Our technology, the computers, whenever there's a technological fix, all I'm thinking about is all the microchips that need to be made for these emerging technologies that are, the, quote-unquote, the future to automate things. And where do the microchips come from? What are they made of? They're made of materials that come from people who literally have to be slaves. And so our wealth, our ability to, say, spend more of the national budget towards social services, full health care, education, it still needs to be funded by something, right? The profits of corporations, right, to raise taxes on the rich. They're rich because of the wealth that is taken from the rest of the world. So there's a, you know, contradiction there. Rather, there's a big problem. Now, why do I preface with this? Because I'm trying to get to a story here that social democrats, you know, the Bernie Sanders, Bernie-crats, those still within the Democratic Party that still think it can be reformed, they're still in a war party. They're still an imperialist party. So in questions of do we go to war with Iran, which is being drummed up, they're trying everything, and Venezuela. Thankfully, because we have such a stooge in the White House, or less of a stooge, I guess, or such a bumbling competent, they can't effectively actually propagate their war, which is good. Trump has not started a new war. That's very interesting. But AOC and other new socialists line up behind Pelosi, Bolton, and Trump in support of the coup attempt in Venezuela. So this is a little old, but this is from Left Voice. Coup attempt in Venezuela orchestrated by the Trump's national security advisor. So the major point of this is, quote-unquote socialists or democratic socialists like AOC still have to line up behind the war industry and the war complex and the empire, because if you're going to have this democratic socialism, we still need to have an empire. And that ain't right. We have to go further. We have to tear it all down. We have to try something completely new and not just the incrementally change, even if it does help our people, but it will be doing so at the expense of others. So the coup attempt in Venezuela, orchestrated by Trump's national security advisor John Bolton, has been condemned by socialists around the world. Democratic socialist Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, however, is siding with the Republican and Democratic parties in support of U.S. imperialism. She said, "I defer to caucus leadership on how we navigate this." That is how Cortez responded to a question by the National Review about how she views the U.S. orchestrated coup attempt. The only substantive comment she gave was, "Violence is horrible." How safe. The Democratic caucus leadership around Pelosi has offered unlimited support for the self-proclaimed interim president, Juan Guaido, who is now basically, he's worth more dead than alive, as far as our government is concerned. Because basically the only way to intervene in Venezuela now is if he is assassinated by the Maduro government, which is why he hasn't been arrested and hasn't been killed. Don't want to give America any reason to invade. Pelosi is not, as she claims, interested in the suffering of the Venezuelan people. If she were, she would call for an immediate end to the murderous sanctions. Pelosi is supporting the attempts of Donald Trump and his people and his special rep, Elliot Abrams, war criminal as he is, to install a puppet government in Venezuela. The Democratic and Republican parties are united in their support of reactionary coups in Latin America. Reagan's party supported Contras, right-wing death squads in Nicaragua in the 80s, and Hillary and Obama supported the coup in Honduras in 2009, which is why there needed to be a caravan here, because we supported a coup there and made life completely miserable and tenable for those thousands and thousands of people. On April 30th, as a coup attempt was underway, Pelosi tweeted her support for the peaceful protests. Right. Bolton has explained very openly that this coup was planned in detail in Washington. It's not, it's all in the open. 2 months ago, AOC was already calling for democracy in Venezuela, whatever that means, while Bernie Sanders was demanding that Maduro allow humanitarian aid into the country. Okay. Well, he does. It's the humanitarian aid from the U.S., which is suspect. Both of these Democratic Party politicians, who consider themselves democratic socialists, take them at their word, were providing a left cover for the Trump administration's narrative in favor of the coup. These coups in Latin America are always in the interests of U.S. billionaires, the very people Sanders and AOC claim to be fighting in the name of the people against. This kind of State Department socialism, which supports U.S. imperialism abroad while claiming to fight for the interests of working people at home, not only betrays the most basic principles of internationalism, it doesn't even deliver the crumbs that it promises for U.S. workers. As Friedrich Engels said, a people which oppresses another cannot emancipate itself. As long as the U.S. is an empire, we're not going to be the revolution. It's got to come from outside. That is the premise of Third Worldism. AOC is a member of the DSA, an organization that has given her consistent and enthusiastic support. The DSA has rightly condemned the coup attempt, right? So they're on the right side. They're part of the left, and I see them as comrades. So is AOC in any way accountable, though, to the DSA, then? Many in the DSA cite her election as an example of how socialists can use the Democratic Party as a ballot line in order to get in office. They could just use ours, the Green Party, but no. But her ongoing support for U.S. imperialism in Venezuela shows that politicians like AOC are just as likely to be used by the Democrats, whose agenda of regime change and service of money is not much different than that of Republicans. Socialism, for being lefty, is by its very nature internationalist and anti-imperialist, and ultimately demands a rejection of all the parties of capital. Thus, anyone who claims to be a socialist should and must condemn the coup attempt in VZ without giving any support to the anti-worker regime of Maduro. Wait. So, yeah, the voice of the left here doesn't like Maduro either. And I'm going to end the hour with a moment on with a critique of that. So the left is also very inconsistent sometimes, and we're going to critique and talk about that in the last section of the show. So this is when April-May, so this story was published May 2nd. And I just want to let you know, this is about Jacobin, or it's criticizing Jacobin and other kind of lefty sources, I suppose, like the one I just kind of read, which is very correct in talking about American politics, but then says Maduro is also anti-worker. Okay, tell that to all the communes that were developed over the Chavez regime, rather the Chavez government. It's called a regime. That is how deep it goes. Don't call a legitimate government a regime. A regime is apparently our way of discussing an illegitimate government. So in that way, we should call it the Trump regime, right? Trump regime. We have to end the Trump regime. Who's going to intervene into us? The rest of the world, that too. We need an intervention, and perhaps China, India, and the EU are the people to do it. So, this one's called Jacobin Stabs Venezuela in the Front. So this is a critique of those that would kind of say both sides are bad and we shouldn't support actual existing socialists, meaning socialist governments, which are still a nation state, so they still have all those problems that kind of discussed before with the Kurds. They're not perfect. They're not great. They're not really where we want to be, but it's a step forward, more so than even, say, if Bernie Sanders were president, which Jacobin just pumps up over and over. They're just so solidly Bernie. It's like the Bernie magazine. I don't really like that. My critique and my dislike of Jacobin is mostly constrained to its editorial kind of staff. When they cover normal stories, I use them as a source on this show. As I just did, that interview with the communist mayor in Chile was from Jacobin. All right, so when it's very matter-of-fact material, I'm cool with it. But I'm not going to read their opinion pieces. Why? So, written by Stefan Guanis, so this is his own commentary. On the heels of another Washington-based attempt to engineer a coup in Venezuela, Jacobin, the periodical that builds itself as the leading voice of the American left, has published an assault on the Bolivarian Revolution there. Following Oscar Wilde's quip about enemies stabbing you in the back, but friends stabbing you in the front, Jacobin contributor Gabriel Hetland has aimed his dagger squarely from the front, though not without voicing a profusion of friendly bon mots about leftist solidarity. The University of Albany academic, he's local, I could talk to him, I could go to his office and tell him to eat it. Another agent of imperialism masquerading as a beautiful soul has done what a long line of left imperialists have done before him. They've consulted against supporting those who have organized to overcome the oppression by Western states. They say, look, you're fighting oppression, but you're not doing it the right way. In his piece, Venezuela and the Left, Hetland draws on a 2016 article he wrote for The Nation, titled, Why is Venezuela in Crisis? In that article, the Jacobin contributor points to the near impossibility of disentangling the internal and the external aspects of the crisis, noting that the government has not acted in a vacuum, referring to the oppressive sanctions that we have put on them. They can't access credit well, and when they try to get around that by creating their own currency or cryptocurrency, that gets banned or clamped down on. But in a hostile domestic and international environment, a reasonable person might agree, the hostile domestic and international environment has structured the viable range of responses against the VZ government. This is the original writer talking. And we can't understand or evaluate the government's actions without taking into account that environment. One might conclude, then, that Hetland is a reasonable person. However, no sooner does he acknowledge the near impossibility of disentangling these aspects of the crisis, the fact that they are under sanctions, the fact that there are internal saboteurs, you know, their power system was just attacked, and he declares the Gordian knot cut. To an antagonizingly large degree, he says, Venezuela's crisis is of the government's own making. It's their fault, really. And thereupon, The hostile domestic and international environment vanishes. Never again the trouble or our thoughts. According to the political sociologist, Chavez has committed several major errors that has come back to haunt Venezuela. In particular, he failed to effectively tackle corruption, dismantle currency controls after they had served their purpose, and wean Venezuela from its extreme dependence on oil. Part of its crisis economically is that the price of oil fell. The price of oil fell because did Saudi Arabia to basically flood the global marketplace to drop the price of oil. Chavez faced a binary choice, end oil dependency or continue it, and the Venezuelan leader chose to continue it rather than end it, and thereby he blundered. But does Hedlund really believe that it was possible for Venezuela, over a little more than a decade Chavez was in office, in a hostile domestic and international environment, to wean itself from its extreme oil dependency? I mean, hell, can we? If so, he's living on a planet of utopias. How many major oil-producing countries have successfully weaned themselves from oil dependency in half a century, let alone the 11 years that Chavez was president? The same can be said about the corruption. Hedlund seems to think that corruption in third-world countries is easily solved, as if a lever simply needs to be pulled, and shazam! Corruption comes to an end. If we think like Hedlund, then Chavez could have chosen to accept corruption or reject it. It's a binary. In Hedlund's antagonizingly confused thinking, because corruption carried on, Chavez must have been okay with it. This isn't serious analysis, okay? To an antagonizingly large degree, it is superficial, a large dollop of virtue signaling upon a veneer of utopianism. Hedlund may just as well have said that to a large degree, Venezuelan crisis, its crisis is of the government's own making because Chavez failed to surround himself with angels capable of carrying out miracles. Hedlund mimics the antagonizingly didactic style of Patrick Bond, Stefan Zooms, Gilbert Ashkar. These are other members of the Academy, who also deliver pronouncements with great certitude on both empirical and moral questions. And they're like the leaders of the left that are, you know, brainwashing your children, as conservatives would say, when they go to college. Presumably, they can't get away with this in peer-reviewed journals, but feel free to stretch their legs on ZNet, Jacobin, and even Counterpunch, where the demands for defensible analysis are less exacting. Hedlund appoints himself as the man with all the answers, as many leftist academics seem to do, able to sort through what he assures us are difficult questions, and to do so in only 1,000 words. He begins his Jacobin article by asking, how should we respond to this crisis in Venezuela? Which, let's remember, was brought about by Washington seeking to topple its government. After which, he presumes to enumerate a series of we shoulds, as if he is a pontiff declaring how the faithful ought to conduct itself. Assumingly, he tells us there are no easy answers, and then quickly furnishes us with some. Easy answer 1, Chavez should have ended Venezuela's oil dependency. Easy answer 2, Chavez should have ended corruption. Easy answer 3, Chavez should have, ... and so on. And if Chavez had consulted Hedlund, arbiter of difficult questions, the whole crisis could have been averted. Easy answer 4, we should support the angels. Now, why am I stuck on this? Like, why am I reading this in the first place? This isn't just about Venezuela. This is about how American leftists, at least since the 50s, have talked about socialism abroad. Oh, because it's run by the state and the state's oppressive. They cut back on press freedom or something like that. You know, you're supposed to do everything at once. You're supposed to be really liberal. You're supposed to also provide good social programs really efficiently. You're supposed to do everything perfectly right. The standards are so high, they're impossible. And thus, the left in America holds itself to these high standards. But then also standards like we should participate in elections with the major parties as, and work for them. We should do this. We should, you know, and thus hold these high standards impossible to achieve. And thus the left in America barely achieves anything. And that goes for, you know, there's of course viable criticisms about the Soviet Union, about Vietnam and the North Korea. Of course. But I would suggest, as this writer is, that we should just understand that people are in always impossible situations. I can put it on a really distinct personal level. Like drug dealing. Right? If you have no other freaking options, can't afford college, no program applies to you. There's no kind of grant, you know, you have to, no nonprofit will help you, you know, the school closes at 4, so there's no after school program. What's a teen supposed to do except be rowdy and loud and do things to pass the time, break things or whatever? You know, just the breaking of a window. It's their fault, right? Oh, yes, their circumstances are hard, they're poor, but it's still their fault. I don't believe that. I think that's very unfair. The writer says, I was struck also by this quote. The first duty of leftists is to provide solidarity to the oppressed. This is Hetland talking. But, the writer says, I would have thought that the first duty of leftists is to overcome oppression. Without reference to a concrete project of overcoming oppression, the statement, we ought to provide solidarity to the oppressed, is meaningless. Counterpunch's Eric Danziger also argued that the left should confine itself to showing solidarity for the oppressed of Syria. But it was unclear what he meant by the oppressed. Does he mean the Syrians who neither support the U.S. government's attempt to dictate the policies there, or those who zealously resist them? Hetland and Dresser are simply calling for withdrawal from the real world of politics and the abjuring of side-taking in clashes between organized project of oppression, like our empire, and an organized project to overcome it. Communist and socialist movements that, yes, are messy. So people get hurt. And feelings are hurt. But life is not fair. We don't live in a utopia. It's not utopian to say a socialist government in Venezuela is better than a neoliberal one. Like in Chile. Because you can go to Chile and see just how bad they were. They don't. Did you not hear earlier in the hour? 85% of the country doesn't have access to a bookstore. For all their attempts to present themselves as champions of the oppressed, quote-unquote leftists like Hetland, or rather leftist commentators like Hetland and Dresser, come down on the side of the U.S. oppressor. Hetland makes a show of acknowledging the hostile environment, but ends up attributing the hardships of Venezuela, of Venezuelans, to endure Chavez's blunders, rather than the hostile domestic and international environment. The regime change efforts of the U.S. government to bring the Bolivarian Revolution to an end, hardly secret, are dismissed as a matter of little moment. Accordingly, the solution to the crisis appears, in Hetland's view, to lie in the removal of the Venezuelan government. After all, isn't it the Venezuelan government that, to the antagonizingly large degree, has created this crisis? It would seem to follow, then, that its abolition would relieve Venezuelans of this crisis. Accordingly, Hetland endorses a peaceful transition. But to what, he doesn't say. Just as long as Maduro goes, the full faux-neutral Hetland will be happy. So too will Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, and Elliot Abrams, among other assorted war criminals. So that bit of criticism and self-reflection, I leave you on this edition of the Three Left Show. I am on Facebook and Twitter, where I post all new episodes, mostly midweek, Wednesday, Tuesday. This is how I aim. All episodes are archived at threelefts.news. I have a Patreon account. Please donate as little as you can. It helps me print more flyers. It all goes to outreach to grow the show. And as well as promote this station, WCAALP, Community Radio. It is not ours unless it is ours. And when I sit in the studio, it feels like mine. I'm sharing it with others. And that is true empowerment. Thank you very much, and be well. This has been Dan Platt with the Three Left Show. Smell.
but how the market will self-regulate. But elite business schemes would still just be dreams without the arms of the state. If you wanna know what they mean when they say we're gonna open up your markets for our free trade, just ask the ghosts of all those who've been killed for refusing to bow down before the dollar bill. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will.
Investors also were worried about the strength of the economy and corporate America's accounting practices. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 128.15 at 95.
The rhetoric is so thick as they tell us we're free, and we've got to cut right through their lies. It's not freedom to choose our own destinies, it's freedom to choose our demise. You can die for their money, you can die by their guns. They'll let you choose your own fate. If you get in the way of their profit, you can be sure you'll be burned at the stake. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will.
They opened fire on the people, and these were true.
People say, wow, I'm gonna shoot you, I'm gonna kill you.
This is CBC Radio.
The massacre of 1,000 unarmed